Tonight on PBS News Weekend, ICE shootings spark protest around the country as the Trump administration deploys more Border Patrol agents to Minneapolis. Then why critics say Myanmar's first election since a military coup 5 years ago are a sham. And a new book offers a glimpse into one of the most secretive and controversial companies in Silicon Valley.
It enables lots of companies to make better use of the information they collect. Most of the work it does is pretty benign. Some of it is quite laudable, but then there's other stuff that gives a lot of people cause for concern.
Good evening, I'm John Yang. This week's series of shootings by federal agents enforcing President Trump's crackdown on illegal immigration has sparked a weekend of protests. There were rallies and demonstrations across the country. They were organized after a woman was fatally shot by an Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent in Minneapolis on Wednesday, and a Customs and Border Protection agent wounded two people the next day in Portland, Oregon. In Minneapolis, crowds gathered in the city where an ICE officer shot and killed 37-year-old Renee Nicole Good and demanded that ICE leave. Voices of anger and outrage were heard across the country.
Killing people in the streets in intimidation tactics is horrifying, and we can't allow it. We have to stand up.
We want ICE off the streets!
From Durham, North Carolina, to rainy Washington, D.C., and Philadelphia, demonstrators in hundreds of cities and towns took to the streets in a mass protest dubbed the ICE Out for Good Weekend of Action. Some protesters say ICE is overstepping its legal power and jeopardizing public safety. For others, the threat to democracy is just as urgent.
We will win when we come together, because it's not about them, it's about us. Trump must go now. ICE must go for good.
More protests are scheduled for tomorrow. Lisa Gilbert is the co-president of Public Citizen, a progressive advocacy group that helped organize today's protests. Lisa, what are you hearing from around the country about turnout and whether or not there have been any problems or troubles?
Well, turnout has been amazing. We're holding 1,000 plus events, peaceful, lawful vigils around the country, in this astounding moment where people are reacting to an atrocity. It was organized in only 48 hours. And so the massive numbers we're seeing, the number of people turning out, telling their neighbors to turn out, all of it just demonstrates the real magnitude of the outrage that I think people are feeling.
Were you surprised that it came together so quickly?
I think this issue really impacts us all. No one in America should walk the street fearful of masked agents, should be worrying that their businesses could be ransacked or facing intimidation and violence or even death just for being a good neighbor. I think many people see themselves in this incident, have been truly horrified at the escalating violence that they've seen from ICE and CBP. And this moment sparked a tinder. People are reacting to an abuse of power that they've been watching for many weeks and months.
What was the goal for today? What do you hope to accomplish?
The goal for today is to have a community-led, nonviolent, lawful reaction to the horrors that we've been seeing. The deadly violence, the terror wielded by ICE, the abuse of power from Trump, none of it is acceptable. So we want to honor and humanize the lives that have been taken by ICE. We want to demand accountability and transparency and immediate investigation into the killing of Renee Good, and just really expose the systematic pattern of violence, which, you know, does not just include Renee. It includes 30 plus lives that have been lost in ICE detention just in 2025. So calling attention, calling for accountability, these are our goals.
The Trump administration has already said that they're going to send in, deploy more, a bigger federal presence into Minneapolis. I mean, what do you say to that?
I think it is exactly the wrong reaction. People are calling for this non-essential, unnecessary, militarized force to leave. The reaction has been clear, and what more troops will spark is more intensity. And what we want to do is de-escalate, focus on accountability for the harms that have already been perpetrated and move forward. This is exactly the wrong direction to go.
Both Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz warned against doing anything that could sort of be used as a pretext for sending in more federal agents. What do you say to that? Was that a concern when you were organizing these events?
Well, our events are First Amendment right protests. So long as they are nonviolent and peaceful, which they have been and which was the goal and undergirded all of our organizing, we were not concerned that what we were doing could spark a reaction of this nature. However, we know the Trump administration is seeking any excuse to put further troops into the nation, to militarize at higher levels. We've even been fearful, as many know, of the Insurrection Act being invoked at any spurious pretext. So we are, of course, always worried about what the Trump administration will do. They have clear authoritarian goals. But I think what we can control is how peaceful and clear our actions are. And they're needed in this moment of violence. We need to stand up together.
And do you think the momentum will keep up tomorrow?
I do. Absolutely. I think we've only seen growth throughout the day. Yesterday, there were 500 events. By the night, there were 800. By the morning, there were 1,000 and so on and so forth. You know, people are really outraged, and it's showing up everywhere across the country, and we expect it to continue building.
Lisa Gilbert, co-president of Public Citizen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And tonight's other headlines. Tensions are escalating in Iran as protests near a second week. Today, Iran's attorney general warned that protesters could face the death penalty. President Trump has warned of retribution if peaceful protesters are met with violence. Despite efforts to clamp down on dissent, demonstrations have grown, fueled by anger with the hardline ruling regime and the worsening economy. Human rights watchers say at least 72 people have been killed and more than 2,000 detained since the protests began. The U.S. military confirmed this evening that it conducted several large-scale strikes against ISIS in Syria in retaliation for an ambush on American forces last month. U.S. Central Command said several airstrikes were launched throughout Syria as part of Operation Hawkeye Strike. It's an effort to target Islamic terrorism and prevent future attacks. Last month's attack killed two U.S. troops and a civilian translator working in Palmyra. President Trump has moved to tighten U.S. control over revenue from the sale of Venezuelan oil. An executive order aims to prevent legal claims on the funds by putting the money beyond the reach of the courts. The administration says the purpose is to ensure economic and political stability in Venezuela and to curb illegal immigration. It says the money will be the property of Venezuela, but will be held in U.S. Treasury accounts. Mr. Trump signed the order after meeting with more than a dozen oil executives at the White House in an effort to raise $100 billion in investments to fix Venezuela's oil infrastructure. And rescuers in the Philippines say there's hope of finding more survivors in a massive avalanche of garbage. Disaster response teams say they're sending special equipment to the scene after detecting signs of life. Four people were killed and dozens went missing on Thursday after a mountain of garbage suddenly collapsed. Rescuers have been racing the clock to find survivors. So far, 12 injured workers have been rescued. Still to come on PBS News Weekend. With voting underway in Myanmar, what's at stake as the country's civil war rages on? And a peek behind the curtain of one of Silicon Valley's most secretive and controversial companies.
This is PBS News Weekend from the David M. Rubenstein Studio at WETA in Washington, home of the PBS News Hour, weeknights on PBS.
This weekend in Myanmar, which is also known as Burma, the second phase of national elections is underway. It's the first election since the ruling military regime seized power 5 years ago. But with major opposition parties barred from participating, leaders jailed, and an ongoing civil war keeping many from voting, the process is widely criticized as a sham. Special correspondent Kira Kay has our story.
The newsroom of the Democratic Voice of Burma, DVB, is on countdown. Their 2 p.m. broadcast about to go live. Today's news is the bombing of a hospital by the Burmese military. who took control of the country in a coup 5 years ago. Although the junta says they were striking rebels they are fighting, DVB's reporters confirm that 34 civilians were killed, including a pregnant woman and a three-month-old baby.
You see all this bombing in Gaza, or bombing in Ukraine, almost every day on the TV. And similar thing happening in Burma every day. We're seeing two or three airstrikes every day.
HN9, DVB's founder, relies on a network of journalists who risk their lives daily to get footage out of the country. The newsroom sits in northern Thailand.
And this is all across the country?
Yes.
It had been founded in exile in 1992 and now finds itself there again after the coup. Life in Myanmar today is a far cry from its so-called decade of hope, which began in 2010 when the long-repressed country first tentatively opened to the world and tried democracy. That's when Nobel Prize-winning opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi was released from house arrest, allowed to run for parliament, and eventually became the country's de facto leader. The United States engaged, funding democracy efforts and encouraging investment. Newsrooms opened.
We were quite excited, you know, to be able to move back to Burma. We were able to travel around the country. We can do stories from anywhere. And young people are really enjoying the freedom, like mobile phone, internet. Like, it's affordable to almost everybody. And lots of foreign companies are coming in. So it's a pretty promising future for the country.
But the military never fully let go. The constitution guaranteed them 25% of the seats in parliament, giving them an effective veto over true reform. And the army's genocide of the minority Rohingya people, which happened under Aung San Suu Kyi's leadership, was a black stain on her reputation. She walked a fragile line with the military from the beginning.
If you have read the present constitution, you will understand that without the backing of the military, we can never say that we are really on the road to democracy.
Then on February 1, 2021, following another humiliating loss at the polls and claiming election fraud, the military ended the democracy experiment. Newly elected parliamentarians, including these three from Aung San Suu Kyi's party, were about to be sworn in for the new term.
They detained us, regional representatives-elect, at 2 a.m. in our homes. Some of the male representatives were taken away with hoods over their heads. Civil servants and students launched a nonviolent protest. But then the junta cracked down.
We had to launch our resistance together, students and other young people, even the general public. None of us wanted to do armed resistance, but we had no other choice.
I took a leading role in organizing units of the People's Defense Force. We held basic military trainings on the border in coordination with people from my constituency.
5 years later, Myanmar is in the grips of a brutal civil war that an increasingly desperate junta has not been able to win, despite help from abroad.
We've been tracing the use of sophisticated weapons of war to attack civilians. Where is the junta getting these weapons? Who's supplying them? Well, Russia, number one. China, number two.
Tom Andrews is a former U.S. congressman and current special rapporteur for Myanmar to the United Nations.
The international community has been not only not providing the requisite levels of humanitarian aid, but have been unwilling to provide the pressure necessary to back this military junta off.
Western sanctions on jet fuel and Myanmar's banking systems have been partial and uncoordinated. The Trump administration dropped some American sanctions on allies of the ruling generals this summer. Aung San Suu Kyi, where has she been? Has anyone seen her?
No, we just don't know what her condition is. We don't know where she is. We've heard reports of her being moved to harsher conditions, but it's very, very difficult to get information.
While fighting rages in the country, across the border in neighboring Thailand, a pro-democracy movement is flourishing, comprised of once-elected leaders.
I will try my best to take down this military junta.
The NewsHour first met Naypon Lat 10 years ago, as he registered to be a first-time candidate with his father in tow. We next met him in hiding in 2022 as he helped establish a pro-democracy national cabinet. He admits he's tired, but no less determined.
The young generation and Generation Z, they are fighting against the military junta forces in the battlefield. Compared with them, you know, my situation is not so bad.
Those young forces have gained territory from junta control, and local administrations are taking over with guidance from the pro-democracy leadership.
In some control area, we have to give the public service to the people, especially education and also the healthcare system, and also there are so many public service things. So we are trying to give that kind of public service to the people.
The women parliamentarians are also actively coordinating aid and services for the communities in most desperate need.
Now we're collecting taxes and rely on that money for public services.
Electricity and
my ministry is the Ministry of Electricity and Energy. We oversee road construction and can also provide electricity to hundreds of villages.
But now, despite having lost control of significant parts of the country, Myanmar's military government has decided this is the time to hold a new nationwide election.
The junta knows how much they would lose in a free and fair election, so they're doing everything possible to go through this ruse, this charade of an election. We're going to make sure that the actual political parties that would overwhelmingly win, that they're all outlawed. We'll make sure that freedom of speech is outlawed and hope that the international community is going to ignore everything and accept this so-called election.
Inside Myanmar, brave Burmese activists are urging a boycott, openly on public streets, at great risk to their lives. There have already been more than 300 arrests under a new so-called election interference law, with violators facing the potential of the death penalty.
I feel abandoned and have much less faith in democracy. The world doesn't need to do a lot of things to help Myanmar. First, recognize our truly elected leadership. Put pressure on for the release of our leaders. Help prevent jet fuel and arms by sanctioning and other methods. And strongly reject these sham elections.
You have champions on the front lines of the very values that are supposed to be about what Americans are all about. It's also in our national security interest. This is a very strategically important part of the world, the natural resources that are there. The United States and other countries really have an opportunity here to stand for principle, but also seize strategic interest.
Myanmar's military government says it will announce final results after a third round of voting at the end of January. Voter turnout so far has been low. For PBS News Weekend, I'm Kira Kay, along Thailand's border with Myanmar.
On January 26th, the Trump administration will end temporary protected status for about 4,000 Burmese refugees in the United States, saying it's now safe for them to return. Advocates for these refugees say most of them are human rights defenders who would be targeted by the military regime if they were forced to go back. Multi-million-dollar Palantir Technologies is one of the most secretive and powerful companies in Silicon Valley. It develops software that can quickly analyze massive amounts of data. It's used by government agencies, the military, and major corporations. A new book, The Philosopher in the Valley, Alex Karp, Palantir, and the Rise of the Surveillance State, gives readers a glimpse inside this controversial tech firm and its outspoken and colorful CEO. Ali Rogan spoke with the author, New York Times Magazine contributing writer Michael Steinberger.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us. Let's start with the most essential question. Who is Alex Karp and what is Palantir?
Alex Karp is the CEO and co-founder of Palantir. And Palantir is a technology firm that specializes in data analytics. It makes software that enables organizations to make faster, more efficient use of their own data. It's important to clear up some of the things that Palantir doesn't do. It doesn't collect data, it doesn't store data, and it doesn't sell data. It just enables organizations, and these are typically large organizations, to make better use of their own data.
Depending on who you talk to, Palantir is an amazing tool for data collection and efficiency, or it's very dangerous technology that has potential for great abuse. Why is it that this company arouses such strong feelings on both sides?
Because both of those things are true. It enables lots of companies to make better use of the information they collect. It makes their businesses more efficient, their operations more efficient. But Palantir also works, you know, for instance, with the CIA and a number of other clandestine services. Its technology is being used now by ICE to help facilitate deportations here in the United States. So it's used by a wide range of organizations. Most of the work it does is pretty benign. Some of it is quite laudable, but then there's other stuff that gives a lot of people cause for concern.
Much of the book is a case study on who Alex Karp is. And you write about the fact that he is not a tech guy by training, by background, but he does seem to embody the dominant Silicon Valley ethos right now, with a lot of these companies making these very powerful technologies with little to no oversight, with great potential for misuse. But what they say is, if we don't make them, these tools are going to fall into the hands of the bad guys. How do you think about that as it relates to Alex Karp?
Well, that has always been Karp's pitch. He has emphasized for over 20 years now that Palantir takes great care to guard privacy, is very concerned about protecting civil liberties. Basically, the idea has always been that its software can enable law enforcement to find the bad guys without pulling millions of innocent people into their dragnet. And so, you know, his pitch essentially has always been, trust me. The reality is that Palantir doesn't police the use of its own technology. It is up to the client to decide how rigorously, for instance, they wish to enforce the privacy controls that the software is equipped with. And the concern has always been that technology this powerful can lend itself to abuse. And there have been instances of abuse. And there are obviously a lot of concerns at the present moment about how it's being used, for instance, by the U.S. government, by different government agencies.
I want to press on that. You write in the book about how Karp has defended his work with ICE. Palantir has had contracts with ICE for a number of years. And of course, ICE is coming under greater scrutiny these days due to some of its actions. How would you think Karp would explain Palantir's work with ICE if he were asked about it today?
Well, he has defended Palantir's work with ICE. His view on immigration has evolved. During the first Trump presidency, when Palantir's software was being used by ICE, he did not agree with Donald Trump's views on immigration. He's now singing a very different tune during the second Trump presidency. He believes that the 2024 election, among other things, signaled that basically Americans wanted to keep the demographics of the country the same way, and that essentially empowered Trump to pursue this crackdown. And, you know, Karp has made very clear that Palantir is happy to work with ICE to implement that policy. I have not spoken to him about what happened in Minneapolis, for instance, but he has kind of brushed aside the concerns that people have expressed, even people internally at Palantir, about the work the company is doing with ICE.
Your book paints a really detailed and intimate picture of who he is as a person, his eccentricities. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about is the fact that his alma mater, which you share with him, Haverford College, will not invite him to speak. Why is he so obsessed with that?
Well, I think with a lot of these guys, there's always something in their lives, something, someone not acknowledging their success, someone not giving them what they think they're due. And for much of the time that I was reporting the book, it was kind of a jokey thing. I mean, he would kind of joke about it, but you knew that he was being serious. He was very irritated that Haverford wasn't inviting him to speak on campus at commencement or on any other occasion, despite the success he's had, leading Palantir. But it turned more serious after October 7th, after the October 7th massacre in Israel, when protests erupted on college campuses across the United States, including at Haverford. And he was very angry about what was happening on the Haverford campus, to the point that he said to me that he would never give a dime to the school. What's kind of a joking through line through much of the book turns quite serious towards the end. Mm.
Michael Steinberger, the new book is The Philosopher in the Valley. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that is PBS News Weekend for this Saturday. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow.